Mike Halsey. Glad to have you here with us today. We've got a real lineup, two guests and a number of subjects, all of them following the money. I'm going to be talking with John Hatton from the National Active and Retired Federal Employees. He's in their legislative department. And Katie Maddox, who is a frequent guest here. She's with the Federal Managers Association. Katie, are you with us?
Here.
Okay, glad to have you. Listen, I want to start off with, I guess, breaking news, if you will. The government yesterday, and there's some question as to who let the contract, but the government yesterday let something like $133 million contract to manage the credit reports or manage the credit status of federal workers who were impacted in those one, two, or three OPM breaches last year and the year before. What do you guys know about that? John, I'll start with you.
Sure, yeah. The contract was awarded through GSA to Identity Theft Guard Solutions, notifications to the individuals, and this contract is just with regard to the data breach of the background investigations database. So it's different and distinct from the breach of some of the other personnel files. The amount of people that were affected in this breach was 21.5 million people, so that makes that contract a lot larger than the last contract that was awarded to CSID. The notifications will be going out at the end of the month, and they will be handled by the Department of Defense. So hopefully they will prevent them from having the same problem they had last time, which was people were getting emails from CSID. It wasn't a government email address. People were concerned that another phishing
that was part of the
scam.
Hack, yeah.
So hopefully they'll learn from their past mistakes, and we'll learn more about it today with a call with OPM Director Beth Cobert.
Okay. Katie, I know NARF has both active and retired members, and many of them have been impacted by this. The active people are probably more likely, but including many retirees or many people who even just applied for government. What do you know about this?
Well, I know the data breach went back to, I believe, 2000. So I know it's a lot bigger than, you know, what appears just in the media. So there are people who have separated from government either through retirement or they went to go work for the private sector or, you know, are still currently with the federal government. Additionally, also, this breach also includes those dependents of federal employees. And so I know also protection is also going to be offered to children under the age of 18. I know that's always been a concern. You're never, you know, checking your 7-year-old kid's security and their identity isn't always on top of your mind. That's not something that you always think of. But I know it is a problem, so I'm really glad that they included that as well.
That is good to know because, you know, the kid may not have an account, but somebody in Ukraine or in this case China could open it up in their name, right?
I also would like to point out that they've also optioned the idea for providing additional years for security for protections. That will up how much the contract is going to cost, though, up to about $329 million. So we do need to be on the lookout for that as well.
Yeah, this, check your credit, and you will be hearing from this new vendor in a couple of weeks, presumably, huh?
Yeah, like John said, at the end of the month and then a couple of weeks after that as well.
Yeah, and I just want to add that NARF supports extending the length of identity theft protections. Right now it's for 3 years. We think it should be longer. It should be lifetime. It should be for the duration of the threat to the employees and the applicants for these jobs. Congress or the Senate might be taking up a cybersecurity bill that we hope we can include an amendment in there to extend these identity theft protection services for more than those 3 years in this contract.
Right, because one of the fears in this, they don't exactly know why the hack, but they got an awful lot of security information from people, so
right.
But the potential for blackmail. But at some point, just to be mischievous, if you will, they could sell this or give it away on the open market, and that would cause problems 5, 6, 10 years down the road for people.
Right, mm-hmm. Exactly.
And I know FMA members have, you know, spoken to me about, like, I can't change my Social Security number. I can't easily change my name. I need that lifetime protection.
Yeah, okay. Very good, very good. John, I know you guys have been working on this Medicare situation, and I've tried to read up on it. I'm very confused about the Part B premiums, the possibility of a price increase or a premium increase for some people.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely a problem that we're looking to address this fall. whether through legislation or through pushing for administrative action. Basically, what happens is if there's no cost of living adjustment to Social Security, there's a provision in the Medicare law that holds individuals harmless from any decrease in their Social Security check. And since Medicare premiums are taken out of the Social Security check, there's a large portion of people that will be held harmless. And that amounts to about 70% of the Medicare Part B population. So to make up the difference, some of those, the premium costs or the cost of the program, which usually amount to premiums usually cover 25% of those are going to be have to taken on by the other 30%. That those individuals include CSRS retirees who don't get enough Social Security to cover their Medicare premiums. So instead of having an increase from $105 per month to $120 per month, as there would be if there's no hold harmless, you're going to have some individuals potentially paying up to $159 per month. That's a 52% increase. And there's no real policy justification for why, you know, two people with the same income are going to pay grossly disparate premiums. So we're definitely looking to address that. This happened before in 2010 and 2011. The difference wasn't as big. There was a difference of 110 to 96 and then 115 to 96 in those 2 years. There was legislation that passed the House in 2009 to try to prevent this. It got 400 votes in the House, so it had bipartisan support, but it never got a vote in the Senate. So we're looking to see if a similar legislative solution can be worked out and if it can get actually passed into law. At the same time, we hope that the administration uses what flexibility it has to lower those premiums from that $159 per month and potentially smooth it out over 2 years, in which case you can use the cost of living adjustment from the next year to help people out.
Yeah, because that's a big financial hit for a lot of people on very low incomes who depend totally on Social Security.
Yeah, and it's not just federal retirees. It also includes new enrollees to Medicare. It includes other people who aren't having their premiums taken out of their Social Security check. So that includes state government retirees from in certain states. It includes people who might have delayed their Social Security to age 70, but they're still enrolled in Medicare. So we have a number of other groups that we're working with as part of a coalition to try to address this issue. Certainly we're concerned about the effect on the federal retirees.
Yeah, yeah. And Social Security in politics is known as the third rail.
Right.
Touch it and you die. So, okay.
Yeah.
Katie, this time last year, you and I were huddling about the potential for a shutdown.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say, I forget what kind of predictions I made. I hope I didn't make any. But, you know, we hadn't had anything serious since the 1990s, when President Bill Clinton and House Speaker Majority Leader Newt Gingrich famously squared off, and there were two or three shutdowns there that fairly extended through the winter of it was in 94, 95, or 93, 94, and I think a lot of people thought that after that fiasco, you know, national parks were shut down.
Yeah.
Businesses, some businesses went out of business because they depend on tourist trade and or proximity to a national park or to an Air Force base, a state like Oklahoma, a state like Utah, which you don't think of as federal centers, have huge concentrations of government workers.
Mm-hmm.
Man, I think a lot of us said this would probably never happen again. And what we forgot was that the members of Congress have a very short attention span.
Exactly.
And I think you pointed out at the time that, I forgot what number it was, but it surprised me, something like 60% of the sitting members of Congress, this was in 2013, I'm sorry, were not in Congress for the last shutdown, so they had no memory of it.
Right. But you would think that their constituents would remember what happened during that, what services they weren't able to get to. Like you were saying, how many national parks were shut down. I know a lot of small businesses rely on Small Business Administration for, you know, various services. And we just really don't want to see that again. Like you mentioned, it happened, you know, in 95 and 96. And you would think, between such a close shutdown between those 2 years, they would learn their lesson. And unfortunately, we've already heard rhetoric already about a second shutdown. And I just really hope that members of Congress remember what happened in 2013, that it cost the economy I believe $2 billion is the last thing I quoted you.
I think that's right, $2 billion.
It costs us $2 billion. Like you said, a lot of national parks shut down. If it happens this around the same time of year as 2013, that's the end of vacation season. So you're not going to see that extra, boost to local economies from, families going on the last vacation of the year. As you said, local small businesses around military bases. I know our national president is based out of Travis Air Force Base, and she knows a lot of restaurants around the Air Force Base that really came close to shutting down because DOD civilian employees just didn't have the money to go out to eat. So we're going to see a huge loss to the economy, not just in the public sector, but also in the private sector if another shutdown happens.
Well, yeah, the spread of this thing is interesting. Producer Lauren Larson is giving us the sign here, so we need to take a short break, but we'll talk a little bit more about the shutdown when we come back here on federalnewsradio.com. Mike Causey, here we are on your turn, talking with John Hatton from the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association and Katie Maddox from the Federal Managers Association. And we were talking about the last shutdown in October of 2013, and Katie and I were huddling about it at the time. And, when we look at, I think so many people, particularly here in Washington, think we are the center of the universe. It all happens here inside the Beltway. But I have a friend from Ogden, Utah,
right,
and, pretty good-sized town. And she said if you don't work for the IRS, the Air Force, or the Interior Department, you probably don't work.
Right.
And this is true in a lot of places,
right.
Huntsville, Alabama, all over the country. And you have a number of small towns where they have a federal prison and a VA hospital, and that's the employer. So when you go out, when you shut down the government, you're really hitting people in Main Street.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. 85% of federal employees are outside the D.C. area. I think that fact gets lost on a lot of people, particularly DOD installations across the country are big places where you'll see, like you said, in Utah, there's the Air Force Base there. Oklahoma has a lot of federal employees. Alabama has a lot of military bases. Same in Texas.
Yeah,
so all over the country. And then all these other installations, you got Customs and Border Patrol, you have VA hospitals all over the place. So, it affects the individuals there, it affects the people relying on those services, and it affects the businesses that are ancillary to some of those services. For example, a national park. There's the people who rely on people going down there to vacation and stay in their hotels or their bed and breakfasts. Lost a lot of money, particularly in the middle of the seasons in North Carolina when it's the high season for those tourists. That hurt a lot of people in the pocketbook very, very drastically.
Well, I remember when they were doing the Base Realignment and Closure Commission,
right,
and they were bringing federal workers into some areas and taking them out of others, and somebody decided that for every single federal employee that comes to your region, that creates 6 jobs. Whether it's parking lot attendant,
right,
waiter, restaurant owner, a parking or apartment complex, that kind of thing. And the other thing, too, many people don't realize in the case of a shutdown is federal contractors, most of them don't get paid.
Right.
Federal workers were reimbursed eventually,
right,
but the contractors never got paid. So if it's 9 days, they lost 9 days of pay.
Right. I mean, for federal employees who are going to eventually get paid back, it's a bad inconvenience, and it makes no sense. It's a waste of their time having, for the ones that have to go home and not work, it's a waste of taxpayer dollars. But it certainly hits the pocketbooks of those individuals who aren't going to get paid back via law.
Right. Okay.
For the ability to do that.
Okay. And another pocketbook issue is the pending or proposed federal pay raise. Katie, I guess your members are glad to, this will be the biggest. The good news is it's the biggest raise they've had in 5 years. The bad news is it's what, 1.3%?
Yeah, 1.3. And I looked it up in FY13. The average federal salary was $79,374. 1% of that, which, you know, I'm going to say, let's just go with 1%. Locality pay hasn't been added into it. That's $793.74. So that's the pay raise that they would get. But that's for the entire year. And there's 26 pay periods in the year. So that's about $30 a pay period. So that's, depending on how big your family is, that's maybe a trip to the grocery store, but you're probably not paying for all your groceries. So it really isn't that much of a raise. I know John and I have both signed on to letters calling for a larger pay raise. I know FMA in the past has always advocated using the Bureau of Labor Statistics, you know, logarithms to calculate how much a pay raise should be that accurately reflects the work that federal employees do and also offers them a competitive salary with the private sector.
Okay, on the locality pay, the fact that the president has designated 0.3% to go to locality pay, does that mean that people, say, in San Francisco, in Houston, in L.A., maybe even in D.C., that are paid more than other federal workers, does it mean they could possibly get a raise that exceeds 1.3%?
I have to look into that, but I know that that's basically just derived to make sure that, you know, you're trying to bring in, you know, the best and brightest into the federal workforce and not drive them out, you know, to, you know, the private sector where their benefits might be better. You know, they might, you know, be offered better health care, better, you know, maternity leave, better vacation days, stuff like that. It's just kind of just one option to bring in more people to the federal workforce.
Yeah. What was announced in the alternative pay plan that President Obama sent to Congress was that the combination of the 1% increase to the general schedule and other pay scales plus locality pay will be no more than 1.3% of basic payroll. So that does mean that some places can get a little bit more, some places can get a little less, but they haven't provided that pay plan for locality pay yet, and they will do so by the end of November.
So, and correct me if I'm wrong, so everybody will get 1 percentage point, but and some people will get up to 1.3?
I think it's possible that some people could get a little bit more. The average increase in basic payroll will be no more than 1.3.
Okay.
That's all we know.
All right, very good. Okay, now the we talked about the pay raise. How about the retiree COLA? I'm sure most people are aware of the fact that federal retirees, people under Social Security, people who are retired military, get an adjustment every January based on the cost of living as measured by the Consumer Price Index.
Right.
How's it looking this year? Not so good?
Not so good. If there is going to be one, I would predict it'd be very small. It's based on 3 months of data, the third quarter average, and that's measured against last year's third quarter average. So the first month is in, the July COLA is in, that's released in August, and then we'll get the next 2 months in the next 2 months.
Oh, so it's 2 months to go. Huh?
We have 2 months to go,
okay.
And right now it's 0.2% below what is needed for any COLA. So very possible that it could go up a couple tenths of a percentage point over the next couple months, but it might not, could go down some more. So we really don't know, but even if there is, I think it's very highly unlikely that you're going to get more than, you know, a couple tenths of percentage point COLA.
Yeah, okay.
And that ties into those Medicare Part B premiums, because as those Social Security checks are not going up, that holds people harmless, shifts all that cost to the 30% of people that aren't.
Okay. Katie, is there any, I know all of the groups have urged the White House to make the pay raise more than 1.3%, but is there any realistic hope that'll happen?
I can hope. And I know legislation has been introduced in the House and the Senate calling for a 3.8% raise. But at this point, no one has been vocally supportive outside, you know, those Beltway members of Congress for a pay raise. You know, we're not really seeing any vocal, real, you know, hip, hip hoorays for a 1.3% raise. But luckily, we're also not seeing anything against it. And unfortunately, I think it's one of those things where you really have to wonder if we, you know, call for a greater raise, is that just going to bring more attention to it and let members of Congress know, like, well, federal employees are costing, you know, pay raise would cost this much. you know, does that put a target on our back, you know, calling for, you know, say another freeze or anything like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, this is a bad year to have a target on your back.
Yeah, and it's just one of those things where, you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't, you know, there's no real good solution.
I'd ask both of you on this. The fiscal year begins October 1, and given the congressional work schedule or lack of same this year, I think they've taken a record number of days off. But they're going to come back, and when they return, I think somebody calculated they will have 9 working days between their, mm-hmm. the Labor Day recess and October 1, and then they're going to take another break, presumably, for mm-hmm. something or other. And, I mean, is this about it for the year for Congress, these 9 work days? What do you think, both of you?
Well, I think they have a short amount of time between now and October to pass some type of government funding. I think it's very likely to be a continuing resolution, but there is the threat of a shutdown, particularly as some of these political issues come up. You know, for example, a vote on funding Planned Parenthood. That could potentially lead to a shutdown. But I think most likely, and what at least Republican leadership in Congress wants to do, they want to avoid a shutdown. And so I think the most likely thing is that we get a continuing resolution that brings us to November, and then there's a few other things on the agenda, for example, highway funding. That expires at the end of October. So there'll be a few things that Congress needs to deal with. I think the timeline for them to get things done goes to December, not the end of October. So between now and whenever Congress adjourns for the year is when we're going to be facing those fights over the budget, whether it's a pay-for highway or a pay-for for sequestration offset. And those, you know, potential pay-fors include reducing the rate of return on the G fund, or increasing payroll contributions towards retirement, whether for current employees or for new hires. So those, I think, are our main fights between now and the end of the year on the budget.
Is it possible that something like the proposed treaty with Iran, could that trigger a shutdown?
I don't think that will trigger a shutdown, no. I think it will take up time on the schedule, which pushes, you know, the amount of time they had to do productive things back. And so, you know, if they're fighting the Planned Parenthood funding fight later and closer to that October 1 deadline because the Iran deal is taking up a lot of time, I think that could cause potential, maybe a short-term shutdown.
Take a short break here. When we get back, Katie, I want you to jump in on that, if you will.
Will do.
Be back right here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with John Hatton and Katie Maddox. John is with the National Active and Retired Federal Employees. Katie is with Federal Managers Association. And before the commercial break, Katie, we were talking about the timeline left for this year. The fiscal year, the government fiscal year, begins October 1. The House and Senate are not going to come back until after Labor Day. And they'll come back technically after Labor Day, but they'll be straggling in for several days after that. Somebody's figured out that they'll have 9 working days between their return and October 1. What does that mean for feds?
You know, I'm going to have to agree with John what he said previously, that we're going to see another CR, mm-hmm. You know, by October 1st. And, you know, FMA has always said, like, this is no way to run the government. I know it puts our members, you know, kind of in a bind because you're using short-term financial planning for projects that require long-term financial planning, and you can't really, you know, look out into the future and what kind of money you need to just do basic, you know, operations and maintenance. And so that's really just costly in the long run, and we really need to go back to the appropriations process.
Another subject, and it's something I've read a lot about, I still don't understand it, but many people are perturbed about it, angry, and that is the fact that they're talking about changing the G fund rate in the federal retirement, the thrift savings plan. And the G fund, for those who are not familiar with it, that's the Treasury Securities Fund. It's special. It's issued only to people in the G fund itself, the federal thrift savings plan, and Social Security, as I understand it.
Right.
But it's not available to the general public. It's as safe as it gets. And it pays a rate set by the Treasury, but they're going to change it?
I know both the House and Senate on separate occasions have proposed changing the rate of return on the G fund in order to save to save money and use as a pay for other pieces of legislation. But basically, what they did not realize is that by changing the rate of return, you would basically, you know, make the G fund worthless, and you would see a lot of people just leaving the G fund, just basically going to other, you know, funds within TSP in order to save for their retirement. And members of Congress would not see the savings that they hoped for if they had done so.
Yeah, that's right. And just to kind of describe what the G fund is and how it's similar to Social Security trust funds, what it is they get a rate of their special issue U.S. Treasury securities that are issued to the people who invest their money in the G fund. The rate of return is based on the average of all Treasury securities 4 years to maturity or longer. So that's the same exact, it's based on the rate of return for Social Security, legislative history-wise. That's why they gave it and set that rate. The argument on the other side that's come up, and this proposal came up as part of the House budget resolution, and then has since come up as a potential pay-for for the highway bill in the Senate. The reasoning is that, okay, that's supposed to be a greater than market rate of return because it's a very safe security. But exactly what Katie mentioned is what they don't realize is that the savings that they're assuming from this would not be realized because people are taking their money out. The Thrift Board invests life cycle funds, a portion of those in the G fund. They would take all that money out. That's about $21 billion that they would take out. G fund holds about $193. It's also used as the main part of it, the extraordinary measures that the Treasury uses to prevent us from defaulting on our debt. If individuals took out their money from the G fund, all of a sudden you don't have those extraordinary measures. The timeline between when the technical date of the statutory debt limit hits and when the actual default would happen would shorten dramatically. So I think there's a lot of concerns. There's a concern on the Treasury side for the debt limit. There's a concern that you're not getting the savings you would have. And then also, for a variety of reasons, the alternatives to this safe investment that the G fund provides aren't available to the Thrift Savings Plan because of its size. So, for example, the Thrift Board has looked into a variety of alternative investments that they could provide instead of the G fund that would provide a similar risk-return ratio. For example, TIPS, Treasury, inflation-protected Treasury securities. So, but if you do that, all the money in the G fund going into that market would overwhelm the market, and it would be over 20% of the market, and it would destabilize the entire market for those things. So, because of the size of the TSP, it actually has limitations on what it can offer in alternative to the G fund that other 401k plans could offer.
Well, you both use the term pay fors, and I, of course, I've heard it before. But, and it seems to me that's really a bad way to run a government because it's a short-term fix. I mean, it's almost like a shell game in some cases. Mm-hmm. We'll cut this to pay for that, and then but further down the road, it creates more problems than it solves. Is that right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to health insurance, and I want to get both of your take on this. The Federal Health Insurance Program, FEHBP, largest in the country, covers 8.4 million people. Everybody in the Washington area, throw a rock in a crowd, and you'll hit somebody who's covered by the FEHBP. Covers active workers, it covers retirees, it covers surviving spouses, it covers ex-spouses in some cases. And it covers children and grandchildren of people in many cases, but it is a big deal. It was the model for Obamacare. The Congress looked at it and said, this thing is so good. If we're going to do it, let's do it and get it out this way. It's also so good that Congress got out of it to make a point, and that is we're not feathering our own nests anymore. Mm-hmm. They've set up under these state annexes now, or whatever they're called,
shops.
Exchanges, yeah. But what we have coming up in this next open season, which is November to December, is for the first time federal workers are going to be offered three choices instead of two. Right now that you have the standard, a self-only policy, mm-hmm. or if you're married, you have a family policy. And it doesn't matter whether you have no children or you're like the Duggars, you have 19 children. It doesn't matter. It's a family plan. It's a family plan. What they're going to, by direction of the White House, is set up a self-plus-one plan. What's the pro and con to this?
There's not a lot. Well, the con would be for people who have families, larger families, they might have slightly higher premiums because of this. But the self plus one option should lower premiums for people who are just themselves and a spouse, or themselves and one child. One of the cons from our perspective is that if you don't proactively switch into the self plus one, they're not going to move you into that automatically. So we really want to raise awareness among federal employees, federal retirees, that if it's just you and one other person on your health plan, you need to proactively make that switch from self and family to self plus one. We don't have the rates out yet, but in the call letter OPM issued to carriers, it required the rates for self plus one plus all the deductibles and copays, et cetera, to be the same or lower than self and family. There is some potential concern in terms of adverse selection on who's going to move into self plus one. Could it be older individuals? But by the requirements of OPM, these premiums have to be lower or at least the same. So we don't know how much people will be able to save yet until those rates are out. But we can say they will at least save some money, or certainly not lose any money if they switch to self plus one. So we really want to raise awareness and let people know that they should be doing that this open season.
Katie, what are your thoughts on that?
I have to agree totally. You know, we were very excited to see Self Plus One. A lot of FMA members, you know, they have kids, but they're not dependent on them anymore. You know, kids who, you know, have their own jobs, have their own health insurance. So you are just paying for yourself and your spouse. So I know our members we're really, really excited to see the Self Plus One option. And we're also excited to see that it covers, you know, single parent households, where you have, you know, maybe one child, you know, and I think this is going to be really helpful, you know, save some people some money, and we're really glad to see this third option.
Okay, just to be the devil's advocate for a moment, because I don't have that option of self plus one, but there for years, the Office of Personnel Management, the government, the people that ran the FEHPP resisted the idea of self plus one because they said that they didn't think it would make much difference, but that it could possibly increase premiums for people in the family plans because of adverse selection, and that is older people, younger people. And do you see that as a possibility?
I think, you know, we're kind of looking at the self plus one group where it's a little bit more diverse than probably OPM initially thought of. You're going to see, you know, self plus, you know, a spouse in a family that chose not to have children, or you're going to see more middle-aged people who's, like I said, whose children are no longer dependent for medical care. And you will see retirees. So I think we are going to see a little bit more diversity within Self Plus One than initially thought of.
Well, I know people who the married couple, no children, and they each bought a self only plan.
Mm-hmm.
Because the premiums are slightly lower on an annual basis, but the backlash to that is they have to satisfy higher deductibles. Correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think you're right in terms of the adverse selection point. It's kind of a zero-sum game.
Mm-hmm.
If the group, you know, the premiums are based on the cost of the risk pool. And if you take out the lower cost people from the self and family because there's only two people, they're going to cost a little bit less to insure, and that's what brings down those self plus one premiums to make them lower than self plus family. But you can make a fairness argument that the person who's just insuring themselves and one other person shouldn't have to pay the premiums that are appropriate for somebody with, you know, 4, 5, 6-person family.
Okay. Got to take a short break here on federalnewsradio.com. We'll be right back. Mike Causey, welcome back to Your Turn. I'm talking with John Hatton from the National Active and Retired Federal Employees and Katie Maddox from the Federal Managers Association. Katie, I know there's something that's near and dear to your heart or something you want to change, and that is the situation at the VA, what Congress has done to VA executives and maybe rank-and-file employees.
Mm-hmm. I know after the scandal, members of Congress kind of looked at federal employees within the VA as kind of a scapegoat. You know, they saw a problem the solution, they saw it as, you know, well, let's fire a whole bunch of people in the VA. However, I would like to point out that that only affects maybe the symptom. It doesn't, target the root cause. It doesn't fully examine culture at the VA, why this happened in the first place, what can be done in the long run to ensure that it never happens again. But also, I think that really degrades morale at the VA, and it also incredibly harms recruitment and retention. I think if you're looking at, you know, first of all, someone within the VA, and they're seeing executives being fired, I think they're going to start to question whether or not they are next, and why do they want to stay at a department that treats their employees that way.
Well, the issue was some of the employees were found to be cooking the books in the VA, in I think in Arizona, two hospitals, and they were doing it so it would look like patients were getting timely care and the proper care, when in fact they weren't. So that's bad. They should be fired.
And they were dealt with. They were fired.
Okay.
And however, I would like to point out that, it was kind of offered as a solution that senior executives be placed on at-will employment. And it's also, which opened the door of looking at-will employment throughout the federal government. And that's not really the most thoughtful way to deal with this problem.
Well, anytime there's an issue and a federal agency sort of comes to the forefront, the members of Congress want heads to roll.
Exactly.
You know, look at FEMA and Katrina, Hurricane Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the Internal Revenue Service now, and its battle with some members of Congress over the Lois Lerner situation in Cincinnati. Yeah. But do you both say that right now it's possible to fire government workers, and it happens all the time? I mean, it's not this myth.
Yeah, I mean, it is a myth that government workers can't be fired. You have to go through certain procedures, but they can be fired. They were fired at the VA in response to this. So I think the problem with what's going on right now, there are potentially performance management issues at the VA, potentially other areas. But the policy that Congress is trying to come up with is all driven by sound bites and trying to make it easier to fire people. Well, you have to reward good performers. And even the policies that they're looking at in terms of making it easier to fire people aren't addressing the full range of things. So you're getting rid of merit system protections, but you still have, you know, grievance procedures or EEOC claims. So you still have protections for employees. It's not streamlined. And with regard to the merit system protections, they're basically eliminating due process. The farther you go down that line, and as you go towards at-will employees, you're basically politicizing the civil service.
Exactly.
This whole system is in place and was in response to the spoil system and a lot of corruption that happened when you had a politicized civil service. So these are important protections to have, not just for the employees. More so, it's important protections to have for the integrity of the civil service.
You know, it might be good for. I know you guys, both of you, Katie and John, you both belong to a coalition of what is it, Federal Postal?
Yeah, the Federal Postal Coalition. So
okay.
it's federal unions, employee groups, management groups, as well as postal unions and management groups.
It would be interesting for us in the public, in the media, if you guys could maybe do the research and find out how many federal workers are fired each year and for what. For cause. I know many say that the government has a long probation period. I think is it 6 months or a year?
It's a year.
It's a year, okay. And that's pretty long. A lot of places, 6 months is considered sufficient. And I've been told by many federal managers that during that 1 year probation period, that's where they get most of the bad actors out.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I think I can get you those numbers. The Merit Systems Protection Board did a great report trying to dispel some of the myths that are out there. It had an entire appendix of myths, and it does a really good job of laying out the reasons for the merit system in the first place, what the laws are, what the due process rights are, and it really lays out a lot of the myths that people are using to support some of these policies that aren't based on factual evidence. So,
well, when you break these things down, too, it's interesting. Katie, looking at your numbers about the value of the federal pay raise, it'll be worth about $30 a week to the average federal employee.
About 30 but that also doesn't take into account taxes.
Okay. Right. So.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we want to be complaining about a pay raise, but at the same time, this has been 6 years, right? There's three mm-hmm. years of a pay freeze. Mm-hmm. This is going to be the third year of a reduced pay raise. And when you compare that to the private sector, which you can look at, Bureau of Labor Statistics does an employment cost index, it's been consistently below that. So over time, you're harming the competitiveness of the civil service and being able to recruit and retain the best and brightest.
Okay, good time, bad time to be a federal worker.
Let's say all right. It's all right. You know, a lot of our members, they really enjoy their work. They really like serving their fellow Americans. However, you do have these issues of pay. You do have these threats of a shutdown. They don't like that much, but I think in the long run, they really like their job, and they like their contributions to the country.
Okay, Lauren Larson's giving me the evil eye here, so I'm going to get out of here. Thank you both very much. We'll have you back. Everybody, thanks for being with us. Hope to see you here next Wednesday.
Right, thank you, Mike.
Thank you.